Can y'all hear me? Okay, great. My name's Denny Connor. Welcome to the Energy Forum for Faith Communities and Independent Schools. We've got people from all different faiths here. We've got people from all different kinds of independent schools and some contractors who support those communities as well. This is sponsored by St. Paul's Memorial Church in Charlottesville, Virginia, and St. Anne's Belfield School, where you are right now. And I'd like to thank St. Anne's very much for having us here today. I'd kind of like to tell you a little bit about how it came to be. St. Paul's Memorial Church has a green team, and we started meeting a couple years ago, but about 6 months ago we started meeting, and I am also a parishioner of St. Paul's Memorial Church, have been for about 20 years, and I'm also a parent of St. Anne's Belfield School children and have been for about 18 years. Steve Jumet, who's a teacher here, a math teacher here, I knew he was very interested in environmentalism, and I invited him to come to a Green Team meeting to see an energy audit that we were going through. We were starting to do a walkthrough of our church and look at, you know, where we are losing energy and how we can be more efficient. So we also invited Pat Watkins, who's a speaker today, to come and talk to us. And he was talking about energy audits, what we can do as a church. And it was such a great talk that we thought, this is awesome. And Steve was there, and he said, well, I talked to Jerry Lawson, and Lance Stewart. And Lance Stewart had helped Steve through this energy audit process that St. Anne's Belfield was going through. And so we said, well, let's get Lance to come and talk to us and Jerry to come and talk to us. And, well, why should they just come and talk to us? Why not open it up to the entire community? So that's how this came to be. So we invited everybody, and that's where we are today. The agenda for today is Pat Watkins will be speaking with us for about 15, 20 minutes. And then Lance Stewart will talk to us for a while. We'll have a break, some question and answer period, then have a break. And then after that, Jerry Lawson will speak with us from the Environmental Protection Agency. And there's opportunities to network, so please take advantage of that. I'd like to thank the Green Team, Leslie Middleton, who's out there at the registration desk. She is the head of the Green Team and has really helped pitch in where we've not been able to do things. Wilma Bradbeer, I don't know if she's with us today. Is Wilma out here? Yeah, I know she I didn't know if she could make it today or not. Betty Sapir, and then Steve Jumet from St. Anne's. So thank you very much for all your help. During the breaks, you can go to the restroom, which is out in the lobby, and you take a left around the corner. Please, if you have any cell phones, turn them off. This will be recorded today. For the people who couldn't attend, we're going to post this on some websites. You can go to the St. Anne's Belfield website as well as the St. Paul's Memorial Church website. We'll have information. If somebody's talking about links on how to get information, we'll put that up there for you so you can get to it. Well, let's see. And I think that's about it. So I'd like to introduce the Reverend Pat Watkins. He, at the time we spoke with him, he was the executive director of the Virginia Interfaith Power and Light organization. He is an ordained minister with the Virginia Conference of the United Methodist Church, having served churches in the Lynchburg District. He and his wife, Denise Honeycutt, served as missionaries in Nigeria with the United Methodist General Board of Global Ministries. He currently serves a church and community worker for the UMC assigned to a ministry to God's creation in the Virginia's Conference. He's a member of the United Methodist Women's Division Green Team for the denomination. He tries to live out his passion for God's creation by living his life in such a way as to make a smaller footprint on God's earth. He's an avid organic permaculture gardener. His passion is to raise awareness, particularly among the people of faith, that there is a connection between faith and taking care of God's creation. He and Denise live in Richmond. So I'd like to welcome Pat.
Well, thanks for having me. I don't consider myself one of the headliners. You have two of those coming up. These guys know far more about energy than I do, so I see myself sort of as the warm-up guy. So I'm going to warm us up by talking about the faith a bit. I am a Christian person. I'm a Christian minister, and I speak from the Christian faith, but I'm well aware that there may be those here who are of another faith or even maybe of no faith. And let me assure you that that's perfectly all right with me. I don't love you any less because of that. And I have no agenda with you whatsoever except to express my understanding of what in the world energy audits might have to do with faith. And is there some connection? So here we go. Most of you, particularly those who are a part of a church, will probably agree that the whole reason the church was created, and for me, the Christian church was created about 2,000 years ago, the whole reason why we started anything at all was to introduce people to God. That's sort of why we exist. We think there's something good about some relationship with God, and so we, as a church, we introduce people to God. In the Christian church, we do that through the person of Jesus Christ. The Muslims do it through the person of Muhammad, and et cetera, et cetera. So it's this relationship with God thing, primarily. That's primary to the church. And then we discovered that, I don't know if it was by accident or not, but we discovered that if we have this God thing going on, there's this God relationship there, that God thing forces us, it compels us to be in relationship with each other. That's why when there's a hurricane on the Gulf Coast, you'll see churches send volunteer and mission teams there to put new roofs on people's houses and churches and that sort of thing. That's why we send missionaries all over the world. That's why if you're in a local congregation, if somebody gets sick or dies, then the rest of the congregation rallies around that family member. It's because we have a God thing going on that we have the people thing going on. We love each other. Well, we don't have time to do a complete biblical workshop here, but there is incredible biblical evidence to suggest, in my opinion, that just as the God thing forces us into relationship with each other, the God thing forces us into a relationship with God's creation. It is exactly the same for me. In fact, if you believe God created the people and God created all of the non-human parts of creation or had some hand in all of that, then there's really no difference, is there? So we have a relationship with God, we have a relationship with each other, and we have a relationship with God's creation. And for me, that relationship with God's creation is the one that the church hasn't particularly focused on, at least for the last couple hundred years. And so my particular passion in life is now to raise the awareness of people of faith that there is a connection between faith and a responsibility to care for creation. Let me see if I have time to do one. Yeah, let me do one quick biblical story to illustrate this. This is a story that's good for Christians and Jews. It's the story of Noah's Ark. Some of you might know the story. God suddenly figured that we weren't doing too well as humanity, and so God decided that God needed to start all over again. So here comes the rain, the flood, etc. But God makes a kind of a contract with this guy, Noah, and he says, I want you to find two animals, male, female, of every species you can find. Put them in an ark so you can preserve them so they won't drown in the flood. And so Noah does it. The flood ends. The ark comes to rest again on dry ground. Noah lets all the animals out. And at that point, God did something very important. God established a covenant. And the rainbow thing, for Christians anyway, there's rainbow, which is the sign of the covenant. God said, I'm not going to wipe out the earth again by a flood. The significant piece of the story for me is who God made the covenant with. God made the covenant with Noah and all of Noah's descendants, which are you and me. And God made the covenant with every animal that stepped off of the ark. And God made the covenant with the earth itself. That's crystal clear in the book of Genesis. And when we're this big, if we go to Sunday school, we learn about this covenant between me and God, and that's it. We don't learn about the animal covenant or the earth covenant, but it's crystal clear there. So for me, that's just one example among a gazillion that indicates that if God thinks highly enough of creation to make such a covenant with it, and I claim to be a person of God, whatever that means, then how can I not make a similar covenant with creation myself? That relationship between humanity and the earth, for me, is just part and parcel of what it means to me to be a Christian, to be a person of faith. So what does that have to do with energy audits then? Well, I'm not telling you anything new. The production and consumption of energy in the world is not very good for God's creation, is it? So let me list for you very quickly several good reasons for using less energy. And these guys are going to talk more about that. But reasons for using less energy. It would save us money, wouldn't it? If we use less gasoline, less electricity, less natural gas, we're going to save money. There's security issues, national and international security issues. If the U.S. could be a little bit more energy independent, it would have implications for our relationships around the world. Air quality, water quality would both be improved, and therefore human health would be enhanced. There would be less loss of habitat due to mountaintop removal, coal mining, for example. So less species extinction if we used less energy. Global warming would become a little bit less of an issue if we could cut down the amount of energy we use. And fossil fuels, anyway, are non-renewable. So if we care about generations to come after us, we may want to consider using less energy. All of those are fantastic reasons for using less energy. But from my perspective, as a person of faith, there's a better reason than all of the above. And that reason is simply because I'm a Christian. That's why. And I will use less energy because it is good for God's creation to do that, because I have a responsibility as a person of faith to heal and take care of what God has made. So, for me, it's a relationship with God, a relationship with each other, a relationship with creation. And that compels me to live my life in such a way that I make less of an impact on God's earth. And for me, If my faith doesn't compel me to live my life that way, then what good is my faith, really? It is such a faith issue for me to care about energy. So, thank you.
Thank you, Pat. I appreciate it. My name's Steve Jamay, and I'm chair of the Committee on Sustainability here at St. Anne's Belfield. And as Denny said, we got together in a kind of an unusual way, but we started comparing notes, and the contact that I brought to the table was Lance Stewart. I went to a city council meeting last year, and one of the councilmen mentioned that the city had just was in the midst of completing a $1.9 million renovation project that would make their buildings more energy efficient and their enhance their, you know, their goal to move toward more sustainable buildings. So I spoke with a couple of different people and finally found myself at a coffee shop with Lance, and he launched our program for me. He gave me a number of contacts that allowed me to start a recycling program and put me in contact with a number of companies, one of which we've chosen to do our energy audits. So he's been extremely helpful to me, and as Denny said, we just wanted to share this information, and so we contacted Lance, and he agreed to do this. He's the facilities maintenance manager with the city of Charlottesville, and he's been there almost 8 years. And as I say, he's finishing up this project, the tail end of it. He'll leave today and do a little bit of it. But it's 9 schools and a total of 42 buildings that the project has entailed here in the city. Prior to that, he worked at UVA as a purchasing agent and a project manager. He's again the person who launched me on our path here at St. Anne's Belfield toward heading in the direction of more sustainable school and so forth. So without further ado, Lance, thank you very much for coming today.
May take a second to get ready here technically. I should start by saying I'm not a good public speaker. I'm really glad Pat was able to start us off with some good public speaking. Not that Denny or Steve, you didn't do a good job. But also just to help give us the perspective that I think is really important to this whole conversation. In addition to not being a very good public speaker, I also don't have a great background to stand here as an engineer or a lighting engineer or a mechanical engineer and tell you, with authority that the things that I say are the way to do it. This is really just a compilation of the ways that I've found and developed to get my hands around a problem and then pursue it that have worked for us. And I'm sure that there's a different way for everyone. I'm calling this presentation Energy Management 101, and it's almost a history of the last 4 or 5 years of my career. Part of my job I discovered after I had been doing it for a few years was that of energy manager. Before I managed our utilities budget, and I thought that was probably about all I had to do. And after doing a pretty poor job of it and having to be over budget several years in a row, I realized that I needed to learn a few things, and I discovered energy management as a field and began teaching myself. So some of the tenets of an energy manager's job are cost control, monitoring your energy consumption. Once you've begun monitoring your energy consumption, looking for some baseline comparison, some others to compare yourself to see how well you're doing. One of my favorite examples and tools for that is the EPA's Portfolio Manager. Thank you. It's such a catchy name, the Portfolio Manager, and which we've got a speaker speaking about from the EPA, but it's really a fantastic tool. But I think that I'm just going to see, I told you I'm really bad at this. I think it's important, in addition to having these nationwide baselines that you can compare yourself to have some regional ones. And I think that it's fantastic that you've got a room full of people here who all have similar interests, who are all looking at taking these kinds of steps in the near future, because you'll all be able to compare notes as time goes on. So here's some discussion of the cost control portion of energy management for the city of Charlottesville, at least. And last fiscal year, our total utilities budget was $2.96 million. Almost half of that was for the Charlottesville City Schools. We've got about $1 million budget for our municipal building utilities, and then almost $750,000 for street lighting. That represents 2.2% of our total general fund budget, and I think 6 cents on the real estate tax. So if you can manage to cut a cent off the real estate tax by being a better energy manager, then that's quite a coup. So monitoring your energy consumption, that's your first priority. It's the very first step that you need to to take to begin to realize what you need to do next. So you need to find out what your historical energy use is for every facility. And for me, that's 94 facilities, so it's kind of a big job. For some of you, it may be one or two or three. You may have multiple accounts, two or three electric accounts and two gas accounts and two water accounts for your building and not really realize it unless you're the one cutting the checks. And you're going to want to get at least a year of background. The more you have, the better informed you'll be about how your buildings act. So I mentioned the Energy Star portfolio. There are a few others that are a little more specific to government. But some of the great things about the portfolio manager is that it takes into account things like the size of your building, how many people are in it, how many computers are in it, what your local climate is, what the hours of operation of your facility are. And ultimately, at the end of the day, you get each building rated on a scale of 1 to 100. And if you get 75 or better, you have an Energy Star certified building. You get to put a plaque on the side of your building and call the reporters. And it's a tremendous thing. And it's a goal of mine. I've got 94 buildings. I have zero that are Energy Star certified. But I'm getting close. And again, I think it's really important to have, regional people that you have a network with. I kind of like to think of you all as a potential extension of my own regional network, so I can find out how others are doing things and you can start teaching me things. But again, you can share ideas. You share the same weather primarily. You can share a lot of the same resources. And it's tremendously helpful. I have a number of people that I call for advice on a regular basis. Once you know what your energy usage is, you can engage in goal setting. So if you are looking to build a new building, you may decide to make it a LEED certified building. You may have heard that catchphrase for a method of green building construction. You can even get LEED certification for an existing building as part of a renovation. You can get the Energy Star certification. You can also set short-term or long-term goals for reduction in certain utility types for all of your buildings, or your one building, or for each of your buildings. And you can make environmental impact goals as well. And I found that that was a really powerful, has been a really powerful tool for us. I have had a number of programs, and I find that, some people will hear you if you're talking about money and not about the environment, and some people will hear you if you're talking about the environment, but they don't want to hear what you have to say about money. So it's great that you have that opportunity in both ways. So some of the key performance measures I look at, ways that you break down your utility data on a building-by-building basis, is to look at cost per square foot, either for the month or for the year, or compared to this month, this October versus past October. And there are some handouts of this if you don't want to take a million notes. You can also break it down a little bit, and probably should, into your electricity kilowatt hours per square foot, or your cubic feet of natural gas per square foot. Probably the one I go to the most is a combination of those two. There's a way to add your electricity consumption and your natural gas consumption together to get BTUs per square foot, or British thermal units. So it's just a measure of energy, essentially. It's your bottom line energy consumption. We will have some buildings. We have two buildings downtown right next to the juvenile court. They're the same size buildings within about 100 square feet. One of them consumes quite a bit of natural gas, more than it should, and the other one consumes none at all. It's all electric heating. It's got heat pumps. And so it's really hard to compare the electricity bills of those two buildings next to each other, because one of them's going to be using a lot more in the winter than the other one is, and one's going to be using a lot of natural gas. But if you convert them to BTUs, you can really tell which of those is the more efficient and which one needs work. It's a pretty short skip to calculating carbon dioxide per square foot once you know your energy consumption. And for those of you who want to pick up copies of the slide, I threw the formulas in there. for conversion's sake. If you're spreadsheeters like me, you'll find that useful. The major benefit of this, looking at this really on an annual basis, is identifying opportunities for improvement. Especially in an instance like mine where there are multiple buildings, I can, and I've hopefully compared those figures that I come to national baselines and regional baselines, and I can see I've got, you know, problems in this building or all of my buildings. And you can sometimes say, okay, I should be at about $1.35 per square foot, and I'm at $4 a square foot. So potentially I could save $2.65 a square foot, and I've got a 20,000 square foot building, and that's something like $60,000 a year. So you can work backwards like that, kind of crudely, to figure out, you know, how big of an opportunity is out there for you. This is just a chart. I'm a chart guy. I'm a spreadsheet guy. This particular chart is million BTUs per square foot over the last 3 months for a handful of our buildings. So this one is a year or so old, this example, but this is one way I look at it. This one of the bars for each of these is the current month. One is last month, and one is the same month last year. So every month I sit down and take a look at our utility bills. I feed them through a database which spits out a spreadsheet which talks about 50 other spreadsheets, and it's all really exciting for a guy like me. And then you get to, but ultimately I've made it kind of where it's simple, and I just open up a couple spreadsheets and I look at this, and I get something like this, and I can spot spikes and trends that allow me to go after making improvements. Here's another one. I'm just comparing two buildings side by side. This is Charlottesville City Hall Annex on your left and the City Hall complex, which is right next door, on the right. So that this is, the blue would be electricity. This is cost per square foot. The purple would be gas, and water is white at the very top there. And that all adds up to just under $3 a square foot in this chart. This is from fiscal year 2005-2006 for City Hall Annex. That was an expensive building to operate. I realized that it's time to see if I can find some money to make this a better situation, as opposed to about $1.25 per square foot for City Hall. Again, I was saying on a monthly basis, I look at these. I compare all my buildings to the same period last year. I compare my buildings to each other because I know they all had the same weather this month. Sometimes when you compare buildings to themselves last year, you may have had a pretty warm October this year and a pretty cold one last year, or vice versa. And you know, the major benefit of doing that kind of exercise on a ongoing basis is to find some of the seasonal trends. If you look at a total year of a facility, you may not realize that your spike, your worst periods are in the summer months or the winter months or somewhere in between where you should be more efficient than you are. So it really helps you spot where some troubles might be to target some of your investments. It may help you find some building use issues. If you've got, for instance, in a school, a month where there's no kids in school, your bill should be pretty darn low. You shouldn't have hardly any water use, for instance. And if you're still using quite a bit of water, you may have a leak underground somewhere. It's just one example. Here's another chart of a typical one that I might look at. And again, this is, I'm kind of using this as a case study, the City Hall Annex and City Hall buildings. This is our gas consumption per square foot for the two buildings. City Hall is in red and City Hall Annex is in blue. So you can see the trends are very similar. The lines are very similar. This is January through December at the bottom, going up to 8 cubic feet per square foot in January for the City Hall Annex. But you can see, as it should, the natural gas usage, since we're only keeping a hot water heater going in the summer, is almost none at City Hall. And it's more in the summer in the City Hall annex per square foot than City Hall is in the winter. That was a head scratcher. And then I have some things that allow me to look at, kilowatt hours per square foot per day. And I actually tend to look at things on a per day basis. I average them down to the day. And the reason I do that is because it creates really long numbers. I'm just kidding. No, the reason I do that is because you may have a billing period for this month for your electricity bill that is 32 days, and your natural gas may be 23. Or you're trying to compare your electric bill for this month to last year, and it may be 40 versus 22. You may think you're doing terrible compared to last year, or great compared to last year, and if you divide it by the number of days that you're actually being billed for, you'll find out that you're perhaps not. So it's a method basically to normalize the bills in a given month against each other and against historical months. It's amazing how much the numbers can change after you realize this. And then this spreadsheet, this is just a snap screenshot of a spreadsheet, and you can see there's red things and blue things, and basically I have that where they automatically turn red if they're bad or blue if they're good. So just helps me narrow in to see where we're making progress and where we're not. Again, not everybody is good at spreadsheets. And I want to say how glad I am that we have someone here who's going to talk to you a little bit more about the tool that the EPA has developed, because it does a lot of this for you without the bells and whistles that I have fun creating. But you don't have to be intimidated by this. There is a tool out there. It's much easier to use than what I'm making it look like. So how do you improve your building performance? There's a number of ways. One is just due diligence. This is not something you should just do once, get your history and go, here we are. You really need to take a look at this stuff every month and review it. You need to sit down and review the stuff with the people who can also make a difference. So being the maintenance manager, I can make the maintenance staff come sit in a meeting with me once a month. I feed them lunch. It's not that bad. And we sit down and we talk about it. And we've got buildings that we've been over and been over and been over, and we can't figure out what might be wrong. And we have one in particular. One of the two little buildings I was saying are right next to each other, and one's gas and one doesn't have any. The one that has gas has driven me crazy for 3 years because nobody can figure out what was wrong. Well, we finally found out what was wrong. Last month, we got our first bill day before yesterday, and it was a 70% reduction over the previous months and its average. Just an incredible controls snafu where basically the air conditioner was fighting the heater all year long. So get these folks in a room, ask them questions. What's wrong? Why is it wrong? What can we do about it? You can make a lot of targeted investments. I hate the phrase low-hanging fruit, but it's apt and people know what it means. There's a lot of that out there, and as you get further along in this, you will find things that you'll walk in. You can do that, and it's really easy. You can spend a few hundred dollars and save thousands in one go. Focus on low building performance in your largest buildings if you have more than one. Don't spend a lot of time and effort on a 1,000-square-foot facility when you've got a 40,000-square-foot facility right next door. It may run more efficiently than your 1,000-square-foot facility, but a tiny gain there is going to outstrip your smaller building. So back to the checklist here. Other things energy managers does, they focus on infrastructure improvements once they have all this information and they know what their targets are and they've grabbed their low-hanging fruit and shaken them all off the tree. You have planned equipment replacements. Need to make sure that those are more energy efficient than what you had before, the most efficient thing that's on the table. So basically most heating and air conditioning systems are made to last 15 to 20 years. So it will be, if you just did it 10 years ago and it seems like yesterday, well, it won't be very long before you have to do it again. And technology has changed dramatically in the last 5 to 6 years even. You might think about, if you don't have one already, installing a building automation system, and that's typically for larger buildings, but what that does is it makes sure that your heating and your cooling systems don't fight each other. And it allows you to program days of the week that you were there, and when you're not there, it acts like a programmable thermostat, but it does it for your whole building, or parts of your building. You can have standard hours that it knows. Then you've got a holiday or it's a snow day. I can dial in the computer from home and say snow day, shut everything down. It's pretty great. Or if we have an event like today's where the rest of the school is shut down, but we've got an event in this room and the hallway upstairs, and we just want to make sure that those are lit and heated, you can do just those areas. Lighting upgrades can be costly. When you really start to count how many light fixtures you have, you'd be surprised. And upgrading all of them can be costly, but the payback on those are big turnaround items, and they would be one of the first things I would look at. Usually 3 to 3.5 year payback in your investment on those. One method to do a lot of this work can be energy performance contracts, and I'll talk a little bit more about those later. Actually, I'm going to skip that one. So let's talk about energy audits. That's the phrase you've heard a lot of today. What is it? You can have informal energy audits where someone who knows a bit about energy, like me, can walk through your building and point out some things that are obvious. If you want to take it to the next level, there's a whole burgeoning field of consulting and contracting where they will bring in a team of consultants, mechanical engineers, lighting engineers, sometimes structural engineers, if they see potential opportunity that they need some assistance with, and they will go over your building with a fine-tooth comb. They'll get background on your utility consumption to help them figure out where some opportunities might be, have extensive talks with any contractor you might have who's taking care of your building or staff that you might have. And then they're going to go down, they're going to find opportunities to save energy, and they're going to estimate the cost of that. They're going to estimate the savings that you could achieve based on what your electricity rates are and the difference between what your system was like before and what it will be. And they provide a formal report that shows the scope of work, a suggested scope of work. It's not detailed engineering drawings, but it's enough that you could take to an engineering firm or another company, and they would know what, you know, they become your expert. I've got a copy of the one we got over here if anybody wants to see it. It's pretty interesting. It's about that thick. So some potential opportunities they might find, I mentioned lighting. They might want to install low flow water fixtures and toilets. Building automation systems might be a recommendation. Upgraded heating and air conditioning equipment. Roof replacements, window replacements, these can all be done to make your building more energy efficient, and it may be time for you anyway. Insulation, these are just a few examples. The list is probably more like 50 or 60 different things, but these are the major ones that are most likely to be found. Again, it's a growing field, and most folks out there right now who are doing energy audits, their objective is to get that energy audit done, get it in your hands, and then work with you to execute an energy performance contract. This is the next thing I'm going to talk to you about. So basically, they want to help you do the work. They want to do the audit for you, and then they want to go out there and manage getting it done for you. Most energy auditors will be willing to come out and talk to you for free and walk your building with you, like Dennis Clough from Custom Energy did with Steve a few months back. Dennis is not an engineer himself, but he did used to work for the EPA, small world. And talk to you, get a feel for your buildings. Then he'll, if they can, they'll come in, they can do a back of the envelope audit where they maybe they bring in their consultant, full consultant team, but just for a quick trip through your building. It's not the full out analysis that you would get with a formal energy audit. Since they'll all be willing to do that, that's a good way to pick between them. If you hear about 5 or 6 or 12 or 20 of them, you're not sure who to go with, invite a few out and let them each come in and do it and see what they have to tell you. See who you feel most comfortable working with and who seems to have the most innovative idea or practical approach, whichever you feel more comfortable with. So your role in an energy audit is going to be to provide information to them to get them started, for one, about your building's size, the occupancy, how your building systems are made, if they're are constructed, if you've got drawings. If you don't have anything, then they'll figure it out. But you give them everything you've got. If you have maintenance contracts, you want to get, you know, give them the background on that and contact information so that they can look into that. You, again, a minimum of a year's utility consumption history and costs. And then you'll be a building tour guide. If you're doing multiple buildings in particular, it could be a little time consuming. For the Charlottesville audit, we did ours in two phases because we'd never done this before. We did our 12 biggest buildings in the first phase of the audit. Then we came back and had them do 20 more buildings and take a look at our street lighting. And it was about a year and a half process, all told, for us. It'd be a lot shorter for anybody with fewer buildings. They identified savings opportunities of over $6 million, or that would have cost us more than $6 million to do, and saved us in the neighborhood of $500,000 or $600,000. We elected to take everything that they recommended that was heating and air conditioning related and just say, thank you for the recommendation. You know, we're going to put this through our normal capital procedure, and we actually were able to fund some of those projects, and I can talk about those a little more later. And then we did get an energy performance contract with them to take care of the rest of the work, which I'll also talk about later. So I showed you this slide earlier, the City Hall Annex and the City Hall Complex, which is actually three buildings altogether. We got some money to do a mechanical renovation of that building, heating, air conditioning, installed a building automation system, made some other improvements along the way, and found some problems with the building that we would never have known about, that the auditors didn't even know about throughout the course of that. So this is the before picture from 2005-2006 fiscal year, and this is last fiscal year. Same chart. I think that's pretty dramatic. It's obviously still not quite as good as the City Hall Complex, but it's also a very densely occupied building. It's got our IT data center in it, which is a big energy drainer. So I think that's about as efficiently as that building's going to function, with the exception of the lighting upgrades we just finished this summer. It's going to look, we did that for both of them, so they'll never be equal, and people will always wonder why. I showed you this one before about the natural gas consumption comparison between the two buildings. This is a really confusing chart, but it's the same chart with the addition of the 2008 fiscal year data. So what was the red line before, the City Hall Complex gas usage, is now orange, so you can see it's down. What was the blue line before, which was the City Hall Annex gas usage way up there, as half of what the City Hall was 3 years ago, less than it is now, and tremendously better. I couldn't calculate the percentage off the top of my head, 87%, and just fantastically better, and a lot of money. I figured it up the other day, we spent $72,000 less for utilities in that building last year than we would have if we hadn't done this work. And it was about a $350,000 project, so it's 5-year payback. To bring the environmental aspect of it back around, this is, again, the City Hall Annex on the left, City Hall on the right. This is our carbon dioxide, pounds of carbon dioxide per square foot. So you can see the tremendous improvement between the two. in the 2 years. Other things on the energy manager's checklist include wise use of buildings, considering having formal policies in place, and communications with your building occupants. That slide was completely out of place. I moved all this around yesterday. So let's talk about a little bit about the performance contract that we did. That was the everything that we wanted the auditors, the energy auditors, to help us with. Of the 32 buildings we did, 9 of those are city schools. That's a little more than half of our total square footage, and 22 municipal buildings. There were some buildings that we audited that we elected not to do any work in because those buildings are going away sooner than we thought they might. So between those, we had 7,400 upgraded light fixtures that were done, 1,700 occupancy sensors installed in offices and closets, every kind of place you could imagine. We installed almost 1,000 new low-flow water fixtures, urinals, toilets, faucets. And we even installed a solar hot water heating system on the roof of the central fire station. That was a real unique opportunity there because it's much like a home. People live there. They cook 3 meals a day there. They shower there. It's very energy intensive. These don't work well for office buildings. You just don't use enough water. But they worked great in this application, and we think that's going to pay for itself in about 6 years. So we got a formal agreement. This is what a performance contract is, a contract. Formal agreement between the contractor and you. And what they do is they promise to manage the work. They're going to hire all the subcontractors. You don't have to deal with anything like that. They basically guarantee that you're going to save a minimum amount of money. And if you don't save that much money, they pay you the difference. And that's part of the contract. So it's guaranteed savings. You can't lose. And trust me, they wouldn't do anything that they didn't think was a can't lose proposition. What they do is they have 2 figures that they work with that they show you. One is their estimated savings, and then the other one is the part they'll guarantee, which is usually about 90% of their estimate. So they're going to base all their business models for payback based on what they're going to guarantee. But they're figuring you're probably going to save more, and we're experiencing that we're saving more than their estimates were now. So you have some financing options that you'll work through with them on. One, sometimes the performance contractors themselves will finance it. And then you pay them back on a year-to-year basis as you get the savings that they guaranteed. That used to be the prevalent business model. It's getting to be less so now. You can also go to a bank and get regular financing, or they have what they call lease purchase agreements, just like leasing a car. You don't own it until the very end. So for those of you who are finance wizards, that means it's not a capital that you own until the project is done. So apparently that makes a difference. But you can get a good rate for a lease purchase agreement, and banks do that for this kind of project. And of course you can self-finance for the contract we did. We're going to do the lease purchase agreement right up until the very end, and then the finance director finally got involved and said, let's do a bond. It's 1/10 of a cent, percent cheaper money that way for us. So again, it was a big project. It was $1.8 million. The guaranteed first year savings was $217,000. We expect to save about $250,000, and we will be saving 2.7 million pounds of carbon dioxide per year every year. Change of subject, I've showed you the energy manager's checklist, and another side of energy management is the building occupants checklist. And you can see from the picture what I sometimes think of them. So here their checklist includes lights on for fast reentry, copier ready to go if needed at 3 a.m., mini fridge moved below the thermostat to keep the office nice and cool for the summer, space heater is hidden under the desk for the winter, the cappuccino machine is nice and shiny. it can be a challenge getting people to think about energy this way. And, you know, I think it's challenging in schools, having dealt with schools. Teachers are very focused on their kids. Principals are very focused on their kids. They have a lot of work. They're under a lot of pressure. They want their coffee. And, you know, and they want to be warm. And the kids want to be warm. And the, you know, it's a tough row to hoe. But what it comes down to, my estimate is that about 15% of your total energy use is at the discretion of your occupants, whether the lights are on or not when they're not there, whether they turn their computers and peripherals off at night, whether they have energy, other energy hogs in there, whether they are window openers or leave doors open. That's a big number. 15% of our 3 million is a big number. So it's something that to go after, and it's something that you're all, it's all going to be part of your effort. So how do you bridge the gap? How do you turn Snidely Whiplash into Dudley Do-Right? And again, Snidely, he's got his own mission. He doesn't care about your mission. He doesn't even know you have a mission, really. He's just doing his job. So you have to convince them that, and teach them and share with them that this is part of their job as well. And we started a program in the city schools a few years back. We called it the Environmental Sustainability Program. It was really an energy savings program. But, you know, our intent was to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions from the energy standpoint. And we had a goal of a 10% reduction in our greenhouse gas. So we got really serious about fine-tuning a lot of our building schedules, when teachers came, when they left. If they were going to have an after-hours event, we made sure that it was sized right. You don't need to go into the library that's got 620 light fixtures in it to have a meeting for four people. And we got really intensive about making sure that special events got scheduled well with us, and we set up a calendar for each building that my staff checks every Monday and adjusts our building automation system. We made recommendations to them for each school. Okay, if you're going to have a meeting of 20 people, do it here. 60 people, do it here, so on. And just got some drawings of their building and shaded some areas. This is the most efficient place in the building you can be after hours. We did as much education and outreach as we could make time for. It's very difficult to make time to do this on everybody's side. But we did have monthly meetings with every principal where we reviewed their energy data. Some principals elected to have an assistant principal do it, which was better. We tried to give them sample lesson plans. And a lot of the EPA has great resources for this, so we would try to give them live data and a lesson plan to go along with it into math classrooms, science classrooms. I never really knew if that had much success, but we gave it to them. We sent out emails to everyone with monthly updates and energy savings tips for around the classroom or around the home. We did updates to the school board, their quarterly principals meetings at which I would pass out checks. And let me show you how that worked. We set up an incentive program, and basically, I used our utility history to calculate, you know, about what each of our buildings is spending over the course of a year and for each quarter. So I'll use Charlottesville High School as an example. It's 285,000 square feet. It's enormous. It's our biggest building by far. So it spends, you know, basically $350,000, $400,000 a year in utilities. So for that school, I determine, okay, your goal is $78,650 for the first quarter. That would have gotten them in under budget. These numbers vary from quarter to quarter because the seasons are different. You're going to use more in the winter than you do in the fall and summers. You're mostly empty. So we told them, if you beat that goal of $78,000, we'll give you half the difference in cash, and you can do whatever you want with it. So if Charlottesville High School spent $65,000, then they got to keep whatever the difference between 78 and 65 is. $6,000 or $7,000, and we cut some checks. And so every quarter I would go and pass those out, and then there were always schools that didn't get any checks. And the way I had the system set up is if everybody had to lose as a net. So if some schools spent more than their goal, then other people's checks got lower. So we got some competition going there. We also had a little trophy that we brought around that floats from school to school for whichever one is the most efficient school. For a long time there, we were also buying lunch for the staff so we could present it. And in some schools, the competition for that got pretty fierce. By the end of the first year, it really exceeded our expectations. Our electricity consumption dropped by 11%, our natural gas by 16%, and our water consumption by 22%, which is generally just constitutes letting us know when something's leaking. So we were spent $160,000 less than the year before, despite the fact that we had 8% increase in utility rates. We cut $45,000 worth of checks to the schools, and for the first time in I had been on the job, despite cutting all those checks, we were under budget for the year by $62,000. And we all did a little dance with the Stewart household. So you can see, we've continued this program, obviously. It's been very successful. I change it a little bit every year. But we managed to get a little more efficient every year. And this is really without any major investments of any kind, this chart reflecting that. This is just talking to people and getting them to be more aware about it. And it really has, in many places, become a part of the curriculum and the mindset, and we hope potentially gone into the homes of some of these kids and that they've taken these lessons and to their brothers and sisters and parents and into their adulthood. And that's all I had to say on the subject. Nobody stopped me for questions. Thank you. That's something I've somebody brought to my. The question was, would cubic feet not be a better measure than square feet? And specifically referenced large spaces, auditoriums like the one we're in now. And it's a good question and a good point. Somebody, I never thought of that until somebody asked me the same question about a month ago, and I'm really intrigued by it. I think you'll find for baseline comparisons to. On national averages, that people really tend to look at things on a square foot basis. But I think that for churches and schools, cubic feet might be a better way to go. And it might explain some of the differences that I see in some of my buildings. I might have a building that's, even though it doesn't have any auditoriums, it's got 10-foot ceilings versus one that has 8-foot ceilings. We certainly have a lot of gyms as well out there. So. It's an interesting concept, and probably the way the industry will go at some point. Yes, sir.
I'd like to say, for a person who claims not to be a good public speaker, I think you're a sensational public speaker. This is an extraordinarily clear and wonderful presentation. You said you had handouts. Where may we find the handouts?
I would like to repeat that. I'm an extraordinary speaker. Thank you. And the handouts, we brought 20 copies of the handouts. They were up at the table at the front. We can make more. So if it looks like, raise your hand if you didn't get one and you'd like one.
We'll be putting it online.
Oh, that's right. We'll be putting it online. I guess we'll spread the word on where later on that you might be able to find the link to that. But we could probably make some copies as well. Yes. It's the International City Managers Association, and I gave almost this exact presentation to their national convention a few months back, so I stole it and added a few slides for this one. I forgot to take that part out. But they do have a Center for Performance Measurement that they collect data from municipalities and counties all throughout the country and prepare reports that are very valuable for baseline comparisons. And they have a Virginia consortium of, I think, 34 cities and counties that we also, you know, we all have each other's names and can compare data and our own to each other. And it's helpful, too, for cost comparison as well. You know, if you're looking at cost per square foot in Virginia versus California, you're always going to look pretty good in Virginia because energy is so expensive there. But when you get a chance to compare your costs to others, sometimes you find out that people are paying less than you are. And that's interesting to pursue. Yes, sir. Right. They have cooling degree days and heating degree days. The question is, how do you factor weather into savings from year to year or increases from year to year? The answer is that you can provide or find on weather.com or other places. They'll have history going back for years of the cooling degree days during the summer, the heating degree days during the winter, or fall or spring for that matter, for your town. They have it so you can drill into that exact detail. So you can compare how hot or how cold a given year was instead of relying on anecdotal evidence. I've personally never found a good way to put that into a formula that accounts for that. I've tried. And that's one of the reasons why I really like to compare my buildings to each other in the month we're in right now. Because, you know, it's great to show progress over time and say we saved this much and or we could have spent that much. But I think it's more important still to look at what your next step is and how you're doing right now and what might have gone wrong since it was all right a few months before. Yes? The question is about indoor air quality and how that is dealt with during the energy audit process. It's not a heavy component of it. Of course, if you're doing any kind of heating or air conditioning work, ventilation is got to be part of what you do. So that's a factor that has to be taken into account. Essentially, they have to make sure that there's enough fresh air in the room at all times. In a room of any size. One of the opportunities they do have now is that the building code has changed and actually we require a little less fresh air in the current codes than was required when most buildings that we are in were built. So what that means, if you're bringing in less fresh air on a day like today, you're bringing in less 33 degree air that you have to heat in order to heat the building. And in the summer, vice versa. So as you put in new systems, that ventilation strategy can change and be a money-saving thing. On the other hand, sometimes when you have a very old building, say built in the 20s or 30s, that's had nothing but window air conditioners, and in order to get more energy efficient, you're going to put in a big system, you have to ventilate for the first time, which is great for indoor air quality, but it's not so great for energy management. You're going to find that the gains are going to be not what you might hope they would be, considering all the money you're spending, but the, you know, you're doing it at a good cost. Did I answer your question? Yes, sir.
Are there other cities in Virginia doing the same?
The question is, are there other cities in Virginia doing the same thing? I know the folks at Albemarle County pretty well, and I've sat down and showed them my spreadsheets and my charts and how to do it, and they said, that looks great. I'm going to go learn more about this portfolio manager. So I know they're doing it. And it's a growing trend. There's a professional certification now. You can be a certified energy manager. I have two people on my staff who are training to be certified energy managers. So and We have a lot of conferences in government, and at every conference you go to these days, someone is speaking about energy management. A lot of people are just, you know, hearing this kind of thing for the first time. Still, you'll find that all of the major cities are years or decades ahead of the smaller cities. So the smaller it is, the less likely it is that they will be doing this. Yes. Well, the factor is, it's always been fairly good, but they actually, it's a building that we rent, and before that calendar year, they actually took the kids that occupied the whole top half of the building and distributed them back among the schools, so only half of the building is occupied. Yes. I'll try to rephrase that for history. I believe the question was, how do you balance investments when you've got an option that would be a big bang, one-time, large project, immediate savings option for you versus a project or a series of projects or initiatives or efforts where the benefits would be just as well, but maybe more diffuse, where it'd be harder to say we saved $270,000 with this project. The question's certainly a good one, and you know, I guess if you're faced with a choice, or you're the finance director, or the deacons of a church, and you have to choose between which of two investments, that might be a scenario that you would have to face. I haven't had to face that same scenario. For me, it's really more a matter of energies, almost like a triage environment. You know, you got to get them in and get them out, and you know, you deal with things that are going to have the biggest impact first, per the amount of your personal time that you have to chase them down. And money is really been less of a concern. I've been pretty lucky, though, that we have a city council that is pretty visionary about environmental issues. Anybody else? Okay, well, I'll be here later on if you think of anything. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lance. We'll take a 15-minute break to go out and have, there's a coffee and some snacks outside in the lobby, and please return in 15 minutes, say at 2:35, and then we'll have, hi, would you like to say something?